Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce. This is Literary Viewpoints, and wait till you hear the book that I am going to be speaking about today. You're going to want to go out and get 100 copies. Trust me, this is really good. But before I start, let me send our prayers and best wishes to the people in Texas, and hopefully Harvey, don't strike again. They don't want you. They've had enough rain to last a lifetime. But for those of you that want to help as I did, if you put in the number where you put your cell phone number, 90999, and in the message box, Harvey, you can send $10 to the American Red Cross. You can also access it on my Facebook wall to the American Red Cross. There's the Greater Houston Food Bank, and there is the Salvation Army, and there are many other sites that are on my Facebook wall that you can look into and give, including Global Giving. And I've already given something to the Red Cross, and I think everybody should can at least give $10 to help those people. So I hope to God that Harvey decides to leave them alone. And there are special sites for people that want to deal with, take care of animals, and it's called All Hands, and the number is 713-526-4611. And now, I'm going to introduce the author of a very scary book, scary in a different sense. Becky Kincaid ventures out in the middle of a snowstorm to buy a car seat for her unborn baby. Unfortunately, she never makes it home. When the second pregnant woman disappears, Marissa Rooney and the team at Hope Foundation fear a sinister motive lurks behind the crimes. And there's a lot more. This book is titled Dark Harvest, and the author is here, Chris Petchel. Good morning. This is scary, and the topic is fantastic. So,
good morning, Fran. You know, when you say scary, I smile. I don't know why. I just do.
Yeah, it is. It's a scary topic, but it's a timely one because you don't know if it's really being done in real life.
There were a lot of
scary
things as I researched the book. They're right on the cusp of being possible. It's still a little bit futuristic, but, you know, there was nothing implausible mm-hmm. in the whole plot of the book. I did, you know, a bunch of research, talked to a geneticist, all of that kind of thing. And, you know, when I started to think about what would motivate somebody to do a crime like this, my bad guy, you know, was very much a brilliant narcissist. And a brilliant narcissist is going to be looking to save himself. And so that was kind of the premise behind Dark Harvest, thinking about what kind of crime, who would conduct this kind of crime and why. The why is so important.
It was, because I realized you had to do a lot of research into stem cell research that helped you define what the character was trying to accomplish. Oh, my God. So why did you choose to define the plot around harvesting stem cells from newborn children? As a matter of fact, the doctor that I work with, because my book came out last week, it's called The Daughter's Promise, and he's trying to figure out exactly the cause of Alzheimer's using some type of stem cells from children that are not born yet, prenatal.
Right. Yeah, what I wanted to make sure when I researched the plot, one of the things I wanted to make sure of was that the stem cells that are harvested in my particular case come from umbilical cords. And so the babies aren't hurt during the harvest process, right? They are sent out for illegal adoption to kind of fund it. But the stem cells come from that particular source. And to me, that was kind of important, right? I don't want to be killing babies in a book. That'd be just awful. So, yeah, that was kind of the thinking around it.
That was, I know, as a matter of fact, that's funny because that's what he said that they were trying to do also, but I guess they're trying to figure out from babies' brains before they're born, somehow they can figure out what causes, if they have the gene for Alzheimer's. I know my mother had it, and it was tragic. So Planned Parenthood is devoted to helping unwed mothers and mothers in need of assistance with taking care of their unborn children. So, this evil parent, this Dr. Wilcox, why did you decide the character of Dr. Wilcox as the primary reason for what was going to happen?
I picked Planned Parenthood because I think it ended up being a lot more controversial than I was expecting it to. Honestly, by the time the book was released, with all of the funding challenges that Planned Parenthood is facing today weren't in place when I actually chose it. And I actually thought about, should I change it? Because I didn't want to pile on to, you know, some of the difficulties that Planned Parenthood is currently having, because I feel that they provide a really vital service for women, right? Not just abortions. And a lot of people think Planned Parenthood and think abortions, but it's actually provides health care for a lot of women in need, right? So I think I chose it because you have a lot of young women going through there, and it provides a place where you can anonymously screen to find the right combination of characteristics, right? So he tends to prey on women who are very young, women who don't have a lot of family support, women who aren't sure they want to keep their babies. So there are a lot of reasons, like a lot of things he would be looking for and his assistant would be looking for as these people came in through the doors. And it provided a level of anonymity in terms of, they have, you know, doctors tend to float around in those clinics. So there isn't, you know, one person who constantly staffs one thing. So it gives him a level of obfuscation that he might not otherwise have in a different setting.
You know, it's funny because we have a Planned Parenthood place that's about a half a mile away from here. And what bothers me is that they're picketing all the time.
I know.
And they're constantly, and they don't want people to come in. And every so often, there's like 20 outside or one outside in the sign or whatever. They're not advocating abortion. They're just advocating getting help.
And yeah.
It's sad because people don't realize the real definition of it. I mean, everybody has the right to choose what they want. And they're condemning people even before they know. And actually, sometimes they even block the door so no one can walk in, which really makes it bad. So,
I did a lot of research too in terms of the type of demonstrations that go on outside of a Planned Parenthood place. One of the reasons that stuck in my mind, I remember when my girls were really little, I mean toddlers to, you know, preschool kind of age, and we had a clinic in our neighborhood, not a Planned Parenthood, another type of clinic in our neighborhood that we would drive by every morning on our way to taking the girls to school. And there was an older lady out there who had this awful sign that she would hold every morning, right, with dismembered baby parts. And I remember looking at it thinking, oh, man, you know, my kids have to see that. And then eventually they started to ask what that was, right? And it's like, I don't even want to have to tell my girls at that age what that is. But now, you know, with somebody out there flashing that kind of thing, I had no choice but to try to explain it to them in a way that they can understand that isn't going to horrify them. So, you know, I believe very strongly that everybody has a right to decide what's right for them. So, my own personal ethic is more along the lines of, you know, if I had been in the situation where I'd had a pregnancy that was unplanned earlier in my life, I probably would have kept the baby just because that's my own ethic. But I believe that every person has a right to choose what's right for them. And, you know, I believe that the other right too, the other side too, so in the book, Seth is actually more pro-life than Marissa is. But the way in which you practice that, I think, is really important, right? So not picketing, not restricting somebody else from making a decision that's right for them, but being true to your own ethic is, you know, the right way to conduct yourself.
That's true, because sometimes, I mean, a teen of 12, and the parents don't want to be saddled, or a teen of 17, or even in some cases that I know as a fact, the person was told by the doctor not to have another child because it would kill the mother. And
oh, man.
That's another serious issue. I mean, people, the right to life is fine, but you have a right to decide for yourself. And if giving birth to another child is going to kill you, then you have to think about the rest of your family, too. That's it.
Yeah, every situation is different, and it needs to, whatever decision you make needs to align to, you know, your particular situation at a particular time, right? What's right for you at one point in your life may not be right for you at a different point in your life. And, you know, it upsets me, all of the stuff that's going on with Planned Parenthood and, you know, potentially taking away these options for women who are, you know, women who rely on them.
This is sad. So tell us what happens when Vicki Kincaid learns that Becky, her daughter, is missing and she might not be alive.
I think what happens with Vicki is, there are a couple things, right? There's that automatic panic that you would have and that would stay with you while your child is missing, in terms of, oh my gosh, what happened? Where is she? Is she okay? Right? All of that stuff would constantly be churning around in your head, and not, you know, give you the ability. I would think it's hard to breathe, right? It's hard to exist day to day with that kind of worry. Mm-hmm. But I think also with Vicky, because before the book begins, they had had an argument about her quote-unquote boyfriend, the father of this baby. And because they'd had an argument and a falling out, and I don't know, if you have teenagers, I have teenagers, and I know they can be pretty darn stubborn when they set their mind to things. And so they had had an argument that it caused Becky to move out. And so layered on top of that absolute panic that something has happened to her daughter is the worry that, you know, somehow she drove her daughter out of the house, and guilt about their argument, and guilt about maybe if this hadn't happened or she'd, you know, been more accepting or more understanding, that her daughter wouldn't have been placed in a situation where she was vulnerable. And, of course, that's never true, right? We may mm-hmm. think that as parents that we can protect our children above all else, but, frankly, there are so many hours in a day that we're not with them that something can happen. And Becky may have well gone out someplace else on a different night, and that could have happened to her. So as parents, we think we can stop it, but I think the reality is we can't. So between that guilt and panic, Vicky is going out of her mind with worry.
I would think so, and a little bit of guilt too, because she didn't have the support of her family, and she was taken. I mean, the situation where she was taken is not anything that someone would be worried about if you're going out to buy something, but they were watching her, and that's
yes.
what's really sad. And
yes.
I tried to explain it to one of my nieces that you've got to be more vigilant with what your teenagers are doing. And just because you think that they're doing the right thing doesn't mean that they are.
Right.
And if you're concerned with everything about yourself and not supervising them after school, you're going to get what you pay for. And
right.
I'm constantly butting in.
There's that, you know, ethic too as a young woman, right? Just being vigilant about what's going on around you, right? So that little niggle of fear that Becky mm-hmm. feels in that first scene, those little, you know, intuition that something isn't quite right, I think we tend mm-hmm. to dismiss those because we live in a safe environment for the most part, and we think everything's going to be okay, I'm just overreacting, we make lots of excuses. But those little niggles of fear are something that we need to pay attention to, because although, you know, everything may be perfectly fine, it gives you that mm-hmm. sense of, no, I need to pay attention who's around me. I'm out in a dark parking lot, I have to make sure, you know, that everything's safe. When she's parked beside that van and she's worried about the van, it's like, yeah, sometimes the boogeyman is in the van, sometimes he's not, right? But it doesn't hurt mm-hmm. to be vigilant. It doesn't hurt to, you know, take extra care.
Trust me, I know. I grew up
yeah.
in a tough neighborhood, and I learned
yeah.
that you had to, if I heard somebody, till this day, and I moved and I'm in a fine area, till this day, if I hear somebody's footsteps behind me, I turn around and let them come in front of me.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's just something you need to be careful of. If something doesn't look right, then I'll go the opposite direction. And if somebody says something to me I don't like, I'm going to do something about it. Because teenagers need to be more aware, and parents need to understand that they should not be coming home late at night by themselves. And if they are, they should do what I did. I called my father to come and get me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it pays to be vigilant.
Yeah.
There's an excellent book, and I believe the author's name is Gavin Miller, called The Gift of Fear. And it talks mm-hmm. exactly about these sorts of things, about how, you know, predators, I think probably one of the most chilling sections of that book to me was how he says that predators have an mm-hmm. interview process when they meet up with a particular victim. And what they're trying to gauge, whether it's, you know, intentionally or subconsciously, is how much of a victim this person could be, how compliant a victim, right? And, you know, we're often taught, girls in particular, we're often taught to be nice to strangers, right? To be polite, not to be mean, right? And so mm-hmm. by doing so, it sometimes puts you in a position where you're compliant and you put yourself at risk. So there was one point during the writing mm-hmm. of Dark Harvest that I actually used, I modeled a particular interaction between characters on that interview process, because I thought it was just so interesting and so, you know, concerning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we should be teaching our girls not to be as compliant as what they can be. I know my girls didn't have stranger danger from the time they were 2 through to, you know, 12 probably. I would have to remind them, hey, you know, not everybody's nice. You need to be careful, right? Somebody's talking to you. You know, make sure that we're around. Make sure that you don't put yourself in this kind of situation.
That's so true, because I think I just finished a book called One Among Us by Paige Durth, and she was taken.
Oh,
and yeah. It's a true story, yeah. Part of it. And an 11-year-old child went to the mall. She wanted to buy pizza by herself. Her mother and brother were there, and the next thing they knew, she was gone for 9 years. And
oh, man.
The story is, human sex trafficking, and she became a whole other person. And at
right.
the end, I cried the whole last 100 pages. I needed tissues. That's how sad it was. The ending was really heartwarming. So Susie Norwood is the next victim, and this is something that other teenagers have to learn when they're alone. Don't open the door and make sure you know who it is. So why didn't she ask who it was?
She assumed, right? So because she'd won this contest or thought that she'd won this contest, and, you know, I think we often mm-hmm. are, as women, we often don't suspect other women of being dangerous. Mm. And so I think had the person standing at the door been a man, maybe she might have been a little bit more vigilant about asking questions, but she wasn't, right? And she saw the Pampers or the diapers in Tori's hands. And so she never thinks to question who this individual is. But I think, you know, one of my choices in using a woman as kind of the lure was very deliberate, because I think we let our guard down.
So when we get to know Marissa Tooney and the people working at the Holt Foundation, what role does she play in trying to find out who's doing this?
Yeah, the Holt Foundation is interesting. So
it is.
In the previous book, In the Dark, I'll just go back a little bit to give you a bit of backstory. The mm-hmm. foundation was created by a lawyer named Elizabeth Holt. She was a powerful lawyer. I think she's got probably an interesting story, too. She became a lawyer in the early 1970s, when it wasn't a typical thing. And she put together the foundation because in college she was raped. And at that time, you know, it was harder to find the culprit. It was, I think any time this kind of thing happens, it's hard to be a witness in one of those cases, right? Prosecute one of those cases, because you have to think, what about myself am I putting out there? Am I going to get justice? Is the cost worth it? And so that experience really shaped who she was, and she went on to have like a very successful law career. And near the end of her life, she wanted to give back in a way. She wanted to be able to help people that were victims of crime. And so she put together the foundation. And unfortunately, she also had terminal cancer. And so she dies pretty early on in the foundation's lifespan. So she never really gets to set things in motion the way that she would have wanted. And so her nephew takes over the foundation. And Marissa is one of their staff members. And so Marissa has this interesting role where she was handpicked by Elizabeth Holt because Marissa's daughter went missing in the dark. And so finding Brooke was their test case for putting together the foundation. And then in Dark Harvest, Elizabeth's gone, and Marissa has a much harder role in the foundation. She doesn't have a strong leader to kind of guide the way. She's got Evan, who's also struggling to figure out who he is now without his aunt, and taking over this foundation that he was never prepared to run in the first place. And so Marissa's role is really to keep the foundation running so that the investigators at the foundation can find Becky, right, can figure out, you know, what the motive behind the crime is and who has taken her. The nice thing about the foundation is it's kind of outside the bands of the police, and so there's a lot of things that they do that the police would never do, which, of course, causes some ethical quandaries for Seth, who's an ex-cop. But it also gives them a way to look at a crime that's a little bit different because their motive is different. In a police case, of course, the motive is to find the missing girl and bring her home, but it's also to prosecute the crime. In the Holt world, the only thing they care about, or the only thing they should care about from you know, Evan's point of view, let's say, is bringing the girl home. Right, and supporting that family. So that whole burden to, you know, find evidence to support a case and prosecute, they're kind of freed from, which means that they may not always do things in the most circumspect way possible. And so, of course, that creates some lovely tension in the book, too.
Well, we have somebody named the name of Seth Crawford.
Yes.
And his link to Marissa, yeah, this is cool, was important. So why did they start a relationship and then realize maybe that's not such a good idea?
So they started their relationship in the dark. He was the cop who was investigating her daughter's disappearance. And, you know, their feelings kind of crossed a line at a certain point, which resulted in Seth leaving the police department. And so Elizabeth Holt, being the savvy woman she was, recognized his talent as an investigator and immediately scooped him up to come into the Holt Foundation. And so their relationship began in this really intense phase where he was searching for her daughter. And, of course, you know, the emotions around all of that brought them together very closely. And I think going on into Dark Harvest, the things that drive them apart are first, you know, Marissa's daughter is coping with the tragedy that happened to her. So she is very traumatized, of course, by her experience. And so Marissa is very involved in, you know, trying to help Brooke in any way that she can. But, of course, I think as a parent in those situations, you think, what can I actually do to help my daughter? I don't know how to help her. She's in so much pain. What do I do? And so you always feel a little bit inadequate. And that insecurity and fear for her daughter kind of stirs her up emotionally in a way that makes her very vulnerable. And then, you know, Seth, for his part, looks at the situation and knows that, you know, seeing him kind of triggers some of Brooke's anxiety. So he thinks, maybe I should pull away and give Marissa some space. And, of course, because Marissa has a history of failed relationships and people leaving her, for example, she fears that, you know, Seth is going to go down that same road, that this relationship that was founded in this really intense emotional situation can't possibly survive. And so she starts to worry about, you know, is he really in this for the right reasons? Am I going to lose him? And then it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's one of those, you know, if you think that your boss is watching you and that your job is in jeopardy, everything that you see around you that doesn't go quite right, you feed into that story that you're telling yourself. And I think that's what's going on with Marissa. She's telling herself a story. You know, he's probably going to leave me. He's not ready for a family. He's not ready for this. And so everything that doesn't go right in their relationship, she kind of ascribes to the story that she has in her head about how it's not going to work out, because that's her biggest fear.
A lot of people do that.
Yeah. It's not we uncommon. Sabotage ourselves.
Yeah, they feel that they're not worth it, or that no one's going to care, or why bother? It's not going to work out anyway. And instead of saying, you know, I'm better than that, you learn that after a long time. You got to get tough, people, seriously.
You do, and you need the self-discipline to stop yourself from going down that road, right? And it's tough to do.
I know, it's hard. So who are the detectives working on the case, and why don't they link the two cases between the two girls that are missing?
I think eventually they do, but I think their predilection is to look at every situation individually, right? And I think sometimes police, and this may not always be true, but sometimes police have a theory about a crime and then fit the evidence around the theory. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in the research that I did, which was also kind of chilling, I have to say, about women who are murdered during pregnancy, Most of the time, it's the domestic partner, right? So whether that's the boyfriend, the husband, whatnot, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, feelings about the pregnancy. Maybe the baby isn't wanted. Maybe there's some financial component to it. Maybe, you know, maybe the baby isn't theirs, right? So I think it's very natural tendency at the beginning when Becky isn't with the father of the baby, and you know he's got a potential NFL career in the horizon, that it would be more convenient for this boy not to be a father at 22 and not have to give up any of what he's going to earn potentially to a baby he doesn't want. And so because that's such a plausible motive, I think that they get fixated there. And it isn't until the second girl goes missing that they decide to widen the net, right? Maybe there is something else going on there. Because honestly, you know, you think about what the likelihood is that two pregnant women go missing in the same kind of proximity with similar circumstances. Mm-hmm. It then becomes something about, oh, maybe we are wrong. Maybe we do need to take a step back and examine the motives. But, you know, the boyfriend provides a very entertaining and credible suspect during the course of the investigation. I just love writing, you know, scummy characters. It's very cathartic.
This was an interesting book. You know, Partners in Crime, who I love, they're fantastic. They're the best, seriously. Sends me everything, even if I don't ask for it. No,
oh,
seriously.
Awesome.
They send me emails and say, friend, it's on the way, so just figure out what day you can do it.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Well,
you get to read some really great books.
Yeah, I don't say no. It's terrible. There's a stack of 50 books literally inside, not just from them, but from everybody else in the whole universe. And for those of you that want to know what you should read, besides Dark Harvest by Chris Patchell, you should read it. I finished it this morning. It's coming out next week. This is the benefit of doing what I do. Close to Home, Robert Dagoni. You don't want to miss it. It is absolutely it's so fantastic. In It for the Money, David Burnsworth, a fantastic book run by, you know, another blog tour from Partners in Crime. A-List, that's coming out in December by D.P. Lyle, the one and only man that writes for Criminal Minds and CSI, and he's coming on my show in December, yay. I have read some fantastic books, and then I finished one this morning, and I went, okay, whatever. And, you know, I try my best. I don't pan books, but if the book isn't wonderful, I'm going to just write a summary and not say anything, because sometimes you just find things, and 37 Hours by Barry Kerwin. Oh my God, that's the sequel to 66 Metro. Yeah, you want to read that too. They're fantastic. And on 9/6, I'm going to interview next week John Land and Fabio Bacardi from Las Vegas, Dark Dawn Light. This is John's first attempt at horror. Oh my God. 9/12, New York Times author E. Z. Winsky, The Binding. You'll never touch the binding of a book after you read this. 9/13, Colorblind. 9/26, New York Times author Andrea Kane in here for A Face to Die For. And what better way to finish September with Tess Gerrinson on the 27th? You want to read I Know a Secret. It's her attempt at Rizzoli and Isles and horror. It is absolutely fantastic. And I just finished, I finished like 10 books this week already. It's scary. Look Behind You by Iris Johansson and Roy Johansson. It's Iris at her best. So let's get back to Marissa. She has another daughter, Kelly. Why do they seem to not get along? They seem estranged.
What happened in the first book, and this is a little bit of backstory.
You're going to have to send it.
I know, Bob Dagoni. Speaking of Bob Dagoni, he blurbed my first book. He's such an awesome guy. I met him through the Pacific Northwest Writers Conference and then the Seattle 7, which is a group he belongs to. He's terrific, and I've always enjoyed his books. Kelly is younger than Brooke, and I think Kelly is a little bit scrappy in nature, like Marissa is. And you know how you have when you have a kid that's a lot like you, sometimes it's more difficult for you two to relate to each other, because the things that tick you off are the same things that tick them off. And so sometimes that happens. And then during the course of In the Dark, because Marissa was, you know, completely immersed in the investigation to find Brooke, Kelly was having problems at school. And so what happens with Kelly is she ends up going and staying with her, with Marissa's third husband, ex-husband. Mm-hmm. And so the two of them have a very good relationship. And when things kind of hit the fan at school for Kelly, they both decide that it's probably best for her to stay with Logan, right, who can spend more time with her, who's going to be there and be a support during this time when, you know, when Marissa's world is falling apart. And so that's kind of the environment in which Dark Harvest takes place. It's not so much that they're estranged, because they do kind of reunite and come to an understanding at the end of the dark. It's more situational about the best place for Kelly to be school-wise and everything else to provide her the level of stability that she needs to get her through the next school year. So if there is another Holt Foundation book, there's an opportunity for Kelly to become more of a central character again and get closer to the family. And I think that's always been the intent. It's just that, you know, the period after In the Dark, during Dark Harvest, is so intense for Marissa and Brooke too, that they're just trying to find that place of stability.
I can't wait to see what's going to happen next.
So I know, there's so many fun things.
Yeah, I mean, you could do a 1,000 series on this with the Holt Foundation. That's what's really good about it.
Yeah, you know, I love the idea. I think it's John Sanford who does series of a core group of characters, but different books are told from different characters' points of view. And so they're all related because it's a central cast of characters. But each book may take you out on a different ledge with a different character, which is interesting. And that's the kind of thing that I want in the Holt Foundation series.
That is. Well, when things start to happen and Marissa realizes that Brooke is very fragile, I want, you know, like, Brooke, wake up. And what happens that puts her life in danger? That's what really, like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You mean that twist in terms of when she finds out that she's pregnant and she goes to the clinic and then recognizes the nurse from the clinic, right? And that's her aha moment in terms of, oh, and it starts to put the whole case together. But what she doesn't realize is that Seth comes in afterward to do some questioning, right, and find out what's really going on. Can I identify the person that she's seen? And then unwittingly kind of gives too much information that now the bad guys know that they're being looked for, right? And then in their desperation to leave and all of that, right, and to finish the research, I'm putting quotation marks around that, it puts Marissa in danger because she's early on in her pregnancy. And if they decide to change tacks because what they've done hasn't been working so far, then she's in a prime candidate. Bum, bum, bum.
Well, my favorite character, sorry, Marissa, this is something I've always wanted to learn how to do, is to hack. So tell us about Henry. I love this guy. I love this guy and why he was able to hack into anything and find information that no one else can. And even better than that, he was able to skirt the law and get away with it. This is, he's primo. He's great. You've got to keep him around. This is,
I love Henry too. Henry had a smaller part in the dark, and so when I decided to expand his character, like one of the things I like about Dark Harvest is the relationship between all the folks in the Holt Foundation, right? And, you know, like we talked about a little bit before, they're all kind of trying to figure out what their places are, what their roles are, and struggling with their own deals, right? Marissa about, gosh, do I know enough to be able to drive the business forward? Seth around, you know, what are we doing and is it ethical? Evan, in terms of, you know, can I step into my aunt's shoes, which are like huge to fill? But Henry doesn't have any of those ethical quandaries. He tends to be more of a pure character. So when I made him a bigger character in Dark Harvest, I actually had to spend a lot of time thinking about his motivation, right, and his background, because I needed to know him better in order to make him credible. And so I started to think about, he probably comes from a computer engineering background. background, right? So he worked as a developer, software developer, way back when, for a company that did security stuff. And because he understands the way that computer security works, he also understands the kind of holes that exist in systems and how to circumvent those, you know, barriers and take advantage of those holes. But the other thing I love about Henry is he has a sense of humor and a lot of swagger. And so he was a lot of fun to write because you could, he's a smart ass and he has good one-liners, and I think he's got a very good heart. But he and Seth, of course, naturally conflict over the whole ethics part. He doesn't seem to have his own code of ethics. Is very much, I would call it the Robin Hood set of ethics. Steal from the rich and give to the poor, right? Find the bad guys at all costs. Protect those who can't protect themselves. It's a little bit more like the group Anonymous and what they try to do, right? They try to take down people that are exploiting other people. And because Henry was kind of wired that way out of the gate and has had some earlier experiences where, you know, awful things have happened to people that he cared about, he believes very strongly that no matter what the cost, right, he's going to try to do the right thing from his perspective. And sometimes what that means is he throws caution to the wind and goes running headlong into situations that then become a lot more intense than what he's expecting. So the next Holt Foundation book, it'll be interesting to track his trajectory because he will come back changed.
Oh, this is good. I hate when people kill off my characters that I like.
It's very Game of Thrones.
Yes, I mean, I try to explain that to John Land. He created a book based on the mafia in a hotel with the author that I'm going to be interviewing, Fabio Bacardi, and he hasn't brought Michael Torrione back. He said he's not. He's going to bring back Caitlin Strong, which he sent me the book yesterday, and they go like, oh, see, this is what happens. They just come in the mail. I never know. And, of course, that means that I have to sit down. It's due out in November and December, but when it's John Land, you know, I just look at it and go, okay, I'm going to read that. But I'm reading one that I'm almost done with. I started it yesterday, Research the Insider. And what happens when a lawyer gets stuck between a rock and a hard place, and he gets stuck doing some insider training, and he doesn't really want to. And that's all I'll say. You got to read it. It's scary. So
awesome.
Seth and Henry have a relationship, and he feels beholden to him. And this scene was really great. And more people need to do this. He went to a bar, upset about Marissa, so how come Henry wouldn't let him drink? That's a good friend.
Seth is an alcoholic, and so when stress gets really heavy, he struggles with it, right? It's one of those, should I drink, should I not drink? And it's one of those things where, you know, you can tell yourself a lie and say, I'm just going to have a few, right? Because I deserve it. I need it. I've had a horrible day. I'm going to be able to take a couple drinks and stop. And so I think the other lie you sometimes tell yourself is, what does it matter? Right. So your life is, you look at your life and you're going, I've screwed up anyway. I might as well, you know, why am I not, you know, doing it? So anyway, Seth goes to the bar and it's kind of his mindset, just kind of, you know, I deserve this. I can't hack what's going on in my life. And Henry follows him. Henry has been like this, yappy little dog, right, throughout the book in terms of, you know, kind of pushing Seth and making sure Seth is okay, or, you know, asking provocative questions. And so when Henry comes into the bar, I think Henry knows full well what Seth's history is and doesn't want to let him drink, doesn't want to see his friend or somebody that he admires and cares about fall off the wagon and really screw up his life in a big way. And so the way in which Henry does it is kind of fun, right? Instead of just coming right out with, hey, you shouldn't be here, blah, 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 he starts drinking the drinks that Seth orders for himself, which is not only, you know, preventing Seth from doing what he wants and being kind of pesky and invasive, but protecting him in a really fun and interesting way. And so I had a lot of fun writing that scene.
Well, a lot of people drink to escape reality, which is something I never drink, ever. And I just don't like alcohol, ever. Give me good old caffeine and some coffee, and that's just fine. Yeah. And today was a three caffeine day just to make sure I was awake. No.
Me too. It was 7 o'clock Pacific time.
Yeah. 2 o'clock in the morning when my husband left to do something, I said, I got up and read. And
oh,
all
wow.
Of a sudden,
yeah.
I got up and read, and I read this whole book, and then I started the next one. And I'm saying, my mother's watching over me because she used to make me read 10 books a week for real and take notes.
Oh.
That's why I do this. So
I love
it. Okay, I need my caffeine, and I just walk to get. So how does Seth come in contact with Dr. Wilcox, and what doesn't he see?
I think that, Seth, when he first encounters Wilcox, right,
mm-hmm.
so he hears from Marissa
mm-hmm.
that, there's a suspect at this clinic, and so he goes and investigates that. But he and Marissa have just had a really difficult fight, and he's very upset when he goes to the clinic, and so he's trying
mm-hmm.
to keep it together in terms of keeping his head in the game and interviewing Dr. Wilcox and the staff, keeping an eye out for anything that doesn't seem quite right. But because of his heightened emotional state and his agitation, I think he misses a lot, right? He sees that, the
mm-hmm.
doctor has some scratches and his glasses are broken from an altercation with Susie Norwood earlier in the book, but, he explains it away by having a toddler at home. And so all of those little clues that something isn't quite right don't occur to Seth at the time because of his heightened emotional state. And I think later on, he chides himself for being sloppy, right, and for not having his head in the game when he did it, because he actually tips off the killer in terms of Marissa as well.
Mm.
And so his mistakes, the mistakes that he makes at the clinic, really come back to haunt him later in the book.
Well, we have to
I love fallible characters.
Yes, I don't like that guy. Seth gets help from the police department. But what does
yep.
he decide he might want to resign from the foundation? Really now.
I think it comes back to his ethics, right? So, decisions
yeah.
that you make in haste sometimes, when he quit
mm-hmm.
the police at the end of In the Dark or near the end of In the Dark, it's because he wants to continue to pursue Brooke's case. And because of the ethical lapse of starting a relationship with Marissa, his boss threatens to take him off the case. And so he figures that the only way he can actually follow through in his commitment and do what he needs to do is to leave the police, right? If I leave the police, I can continue to investigate this with the Holt Foundation. But I don't think when he made that decision that he thought past finding Brooke. And what would happen, in a world once this case was closed. And so as he looks around the foundation, all he sees are the layers of dysfunction on top of it, right? So Evan isn't ready to lead. He's not checking Henry Cahill's tendencies to color outside the lines in a way that makes Seth uncomfortable. He looks at the foundation and says to himself, what is going to happen to these people? They're going to get sued, right? The foundation's going to be closed. There's nobody running the ship.
Mm-hmm.
How can a place like this actually survive? And I think the camaraderie that you get when you're a police officer, right? Sometimes police officers feel like they're one big family. And then also the adherence to his own ethics make it
mm-hmm.
desirable for him to go back. And, you layer on top of that, you're having a relationship with somebody at work and the relationship isn't going so well and it's awkward to see them every day, maybe the best thing to do is to go back to what was familiar and more comfortable to me. And I think that's the draw for Seth. He understands how the police works. They have much more well-defined processes, much more well-defined ethical lines, and so he feels more comfortable there.
Well, I have about 4 more questions. We have about
yeah.
16 minutes. We have time. When Marissa, this was interesting, is told to do some research about donation models for the foundation, why does she hesitate and why doesn't she get it done for Evan right away? Why doesn't she want to do that?
Yeah, I
that
think that is absolutely born of inexperience and insecurity, right? So Marissa comes from a background where she doesn't have a huge background in business, right, which is what you would want for the foundation,
mm-hmm.
right? You would want somebody who's very business savvy and somebody who, understands how to do this thing. I think with any nonprofit, the ability to bring in donations is the heartbeat of it. It's that donation model, that money that mm-hmm. keeps the foundation going. It's like the life's blood. And for her, I think Marissa gets very intimidated every time that she encounters something that she doesn't understand. And her own natural insecurity, right, leads her, I think her first thought is probably, oh my God, I can't do this. Why are they asking me to do this? I don't know what I'm doing. And instead of being able to quiet those voices in her head and go, okay, I may not know how all of this works, but how do I find out? Who are some of the people that I mm-hmm. reach out to? How do I go about this? She's busy worrying about herself and her own lapses, like her own, what she lacks. And so that kind of consumes her. And then also you layer on top of that her anxiety about Brooke, right, and how Brooke's situation, you know, Brooke is not mm-hmm. doing well and she's worried about getting her the help that she needs. And so she feels kind of inadequate on every front, right? As a mother, she can't help her daughter. She doesn't know how to help her daughter, and her daughter's struggling. And then as a business person, she's not sure how to start, and she's worried about asking Evan because Evan doesn't seem to be the type of manager who's going to be nurturing and be able to give her, like, the first couple steps along that journey. He just wants her mm-hmm. to do it. And so she kind of feels out there on her own, and she's struggling with that.
Well, now we have Marissa, and we have Becky, and we have the second girl that was taken, and
Susie, yep.
we realize that there's a reason why these people are being taken. So the reason why they're taking them, and each person has the child, and the parent is gone. If someone adopts a child like that,
yeah,
what rights do they have? This is why I don't want to bring them too much, but it was really like, I mean, there are people that buy these children black market. It's like almost like
yeah.
black market drugs. And they bought a child, and they're disappointed, and then they're told that the child is theirs, and then it's ripped from under them. Do they have any rights? I mean, this was so heartbreaking.
I know. No, they wouldn't, right? So I think when Jared and Sarah adopt the child, they do enough research to convince themselves that this is a legitimate adoption agency. Mm-hmm. And I think the layer of veneer that Dr. Wilcox puts on top of it makes it look very legitimate. So I don't think they ever believed, or at least allowed themselves to believe, that, you know, they were doing something illegal. Yes, it was costly, more costly than maybe some other options that were available to them, but they had the money and it was the most expeditious way to fulfill their dream of having a family, right? And so they think they're doing the right thing. And it is heartbreaking for them, right, when mm-hmm. all of this concludes, to find out that that child that they adopted and that they love isn't legally theirs, and then goes back to Becky's family. So in a way, you know, they're victims of this tragedy too, because they believe that what they were doing is right, and now they're going to lose that child, right, to the parents of to Becky's mom, for example. And so, yeah, that was another thing I thought a lot about in terms of, you know, everybody is damaged through this experience.
Well, it's
heartbreaking,
sense,
right?
I mean, there was a box of tissues at that point, a big one. I'm saying, oh, my God, these poor people went through all this. All this money, it's not the first time, it's the second whatever time, and now
yep.
they're going to lose another child. It would make somebody very disheartened about trying it again. And
yeah.
unfortunately, these adoption agencies, you've got to be so careful, because you don't know what's real and what's not real. And
on the Internet, everything looks real. And, you know, experiences. You can have people lie, right, about their adoption
yeah.
experience and how wonderful it's been. And I thought about this. I had friends that were going mm-hmm. through, I want to say something similar, right? So they went to adopt a baby, and it was one of those situations where the gal was still pregnant. They met the mom, right? The mom worked with an adoption agency and decided, you know, who the best fit would be for her child, because due to her circumstances, she wasn't able to keep, mm-hmm. or she wasn't ready to keep the child. And so, you know, they went through the interview process. They went through months of, you know, supporting this gal while she was pregnant, you know, making sure that everything's good with baby, preparing to get the baby. And then as the baby's delivered, the mom decides that she's not ready to give the baby up and decides to keep it, right? And it's absolutely heartbreaking and devastating for that couple who had been through this at least once or twice before. And so I guess in a way I was kind of thinking about, you know, how devastating that is for somebody.
It's so true. I mean, it's such a reality. It's almost like a shift out of the headlines. I mean,
right.
I know people that have adopted, and I know in one particular case, they had the child for 6 months, and all of a sudden the real mother wanted the child back, but she never got him.
Oh, man.
Some kind of paper loophole. You have to be so careful. So,
you do. You do. And, you know, it's awful for everybody. It's awful for the child. It's awful for the adoptive parents. You know, it's a really difficult thing to properly research and make sure that everything is going to be okay. And I think any time you've lost a child, whether it's, you know, you lost a child or whether it's, you know, you went through one of these adoptive experiences that didn't work out for whatever reason, it's like ripping a part of yourself out.
It is. It's frightening, and it's just as frightening. I wonder sometimes how it impacts the child when they find out. It depends on how they're told.
Yeah,
I mean,
think so.
I know it's scary. In some cases, the child doesn't want to know who their real parents are. In some cases, they do want to know, and they want to find out why. And that could be a whole other book to write, because sometimes they get angry at not being told, or they get angry at the real parents and want to know why. And sometimes you don't know which way is better, to know or not. So what messages would you want readers to get from reading this book? And how much of what you wrote, well, a lot of it is fiction and some of it is based on fact. So what message would you want readers to get after they read this one? Because people, you got to read this. This is so good.
You know, the underlying theme of the book for me was about overcoming tragedy. And everybody in the book, or most of the characters in the book, had lived through some tragedy of their own, right? So Marissa, you know, her daughter went missing and, you know, has had just a horrific string of bad relationships and bad choices, right? She has to decide who she's going to become as a result of this. And Seth had lost his wife, right, in a terrible tragedy. And so he's struggling with who is he now, and can he let go, and can he move on, and can he forgive himself for whatever he believes was his part of his wife's suicide. And then there's Brooke, right, and almost all of them have gone through some kind of tragedy. So I think the message is, you know, people have overcome horrible things, and, you know, looking at your own life and your own experiences and figuring out a way to be okay with them and emerge out the other end stronger. And getting the help that you need along the way for being able to do that kind of thing. That's kind of the underlying theme. And how it can contort you in awful ways if you don't, right? So look at Tori, for example, who I think is one of the more interesting characters in the book. She had a very difficult upbringing and a lot of tragedy, too. She came out of it kind of like Marissa in that she was very insecure, but she made choices for herself that led her down this road. And I think had she gotten the help when she needed it, she may have turned out to be a different person, right? You really have to be okay with yourself, and you have to work on that self-esteem, and you have to kind of overcome that stuff in order to become your choices. You become the product of your choices. And so the choices that you make are very important, and doing the right thing for yourself and making sure that you're strong is very important. So that's kind of the underlying message.
Well, that is true, because Tori, I mean, she was a good character. I don't want to say too much about her and her relationship with somebody else. A lot of teenagers and a lot of grown-ups, too, they don't think through the situation. So in this particular case, the consequences that were involved among all of them, I mean, no one thought through Becky, what's going to happen if this happens? Or Susie, what about if I answer the door? Should I think about what's going to happen? Or even Marissa, anybody. I mean, before you do something, think about what happens if it goes wrong. Am I willing to pay the consequences for my actions? And if you're not, then don't do it. So,
and what can they possibly
question.
Be, right?
Yeah.
Looking at that array, there's the obvious kind of blue sky, even the adoptive parents, right? What happens if this isn't legitimate, and did I do enough research to make sure that I was doing the right thing?
Yeah.
So being very cognizant about your choices and not acting emotionally in the moment, right, but taking that step back and kind of analyzing. You know, I think when you're in a situation where you've grown up in a difficult situation or you've had bad relationships and your self-esteem's kind of low, it's one of those things where the first person that you meet that makes you feel good about yourself is very powerful. And for good or ill, right, hopefully that person has your best interest in heart, but I bet there are a lot of people who have suffered at the hands of somebody who takes advantage of them because they recognize that they're vulnerable, and then they start to elicit this type of control or exert a type of unhealthy control over somebody when they're in that situation.
That's so true. So what is next for the Hope Foundation, and what is next for Marissa and Seth, if anything?
Well, they got a baby on the way, so I see diapers and late nights and kind of figuring out that whole end of it when, you know, you're in your late 30s, early 40s, and that's not the easiest time to have a baby. So I see lots of challenges going on there. You know, Brooke, I think, is starting to emerge from her fog of grief. And so for her, it's going to be about figuring out who she is now. Tragedy has a way of changing you. And so it was like the book that you were talking about the gal who was abducted and, you know, the whole sex slavery kind of thing. You come out of it a different person, and you have to figure out how to be okay with the person that you now are. You have to let go of that concept of who you've been and figure out what's possible for you going out of this. And so that's kind of Brooke's journey. And I think Henry, it's going to be overcoming what happens to him, right, because he never saw it coming. And I don't know that Henry's ever had to do something, that hard work that you have to do internally when something unexpected and awful happens. And then for Evan, it's going to be more of an evolution of, I think Evan might have to dust off his law degree and actually do some lawyering, which could potentially put Marissa in a position where she has more responsibility, right, and actually running the foundation while Evan's off being a lawyer. So I think there are all kinds of good things that are going to happen for the crew of the Hope Foundation.
I hope so, because I like this book. And
I'm glad.
Where can everybody find out about your work? And make sure that I get it, the next one, before it comes out, because that's just the way it is.
I would love that. And I will send you a copy of In the Dark so you can hear the...
Oh, because now you got me going on this series, and this is not good. Yes, it is good. So where can we find out more about you and your work and everybody that's listening? I'm going to make the show go live in about 10 minutes, and everybody's going to listen to this. I've got a lot of people that have been checking it out on Facebook, by the way.
Awesome. And you can find my books on Amazon. You can. I have a website, chrispatchell.com, and it's got links to all of my work and a little bit of backstory on me and how I did this crazy writing thing and why I write the kind of stuff I do. They're not romances. And I have a Facebook page. So if you're looking for info on what's going on with me and what's coming up, my Facebook page, Chris Patchell, author Chris Patchell, is a great way to engage. So I love hearing from readers. I love hearing about what you liked, what you didn't like, you know, what kind of stuff you're reading. All of that stuff fascinates me. So that's where you can find out more about me.
Well, Fran picks at the end of this month, which is Friday. I picked my book for the month of August, and everybody reads everything I write. It's frightening to them. I'm supposed to post your review on Friday, but I'm going to do it now. Too bad.
Oh, thank you, Fran.
Yeah, they told me when I can post this, and I read the book, and I'm saying, oh, okay, I got to get this book done. And I just sat down and read it. I couldn't put it down. And that doesn't happen. It happens once in a while, but not very often lately. But I just sit down and say, oh, God, I have to sit down and find out what happens. And that's what happened when I read this one. I really like this series. So I'm going to have to read the first one.
Yes, I will send it to you.
Between 100 million other things. But, yeah, I want to get to know the backstory of the characters so that when you write the next one, and don't kill off my favorite character, You know, one of the authors, I won't say which one, killed off a major character. And I said, if you kill off this one, I'm not reading any more of your books. That's it. And Steve Berry writes Cotton Malone and Cassiopeia Vid. And
yes.
I went to the Thrill Fest. I was invited. And he promised me that he would never kill them off because his wife would not let him.
Oh, there you go. It's important to have that kind of that spousal protection around it.
Yeah, well, you
thank
know,
you, Fran.
To kill the story. Yeah. So thank you so much for today.
You said my favorite words. Every suspense writer loves to hear the words, I couldn't put it down. I had to find out what happened next. And you said my favorite words.
Well, it is. It's one of my favorite books for the month. So that when I put my picks out at the end of the week, you know, you're going to be there. Cheryl's going to love me.
Yay.
Every book that comes from Partners in Crime is 5-star. They haven't sent me, only once, they have sent me, never sent me clunkers. And for some reason, even if I don't want to do it, they make me do it anyway. And for that, I'm going to do my own blog tour, people, for 2 months, October 1st. I'm hoping more people will sign up till December 1st. A Daughter's Promise is the title of the book. It's my words, my voice, and my mom's voice, her journey with Alzheimer's. And the promise is never to put her in a nursing facility. And although I was in debt up to my eyeballs when she died, $500,000, seriously, until I got full Medicaid and everything I wanted, if I had to do it again, I'd do it the same way.
Yeah.
I would. Yeah, she made me sign a notarized document that said she, when she was cognizant, that you're not going to put me in a nursing home. I said, I'm going to do it right now. You better watch out. Ha ha. And I visited nursing homes, and that was the final never. So that's my book. And my magazine came out Friday. MJ10 is for if you ever want to write an article on politics, healthcare, stem cell research, anything. 11 is going to hopefully come out in October. It's my 10th edition of readers, writers, authors.
Awesome.
It's got my book reviews, other people's book reviews, articles from Alan Jacobson, John Land, Alan Topol, Daniel Palmer's writing tips. Everything is in there this month. And I really did a good job. I'm so proud of myself. And it's in memory of my sister who died, Marcia Joyce, who forced me to do book reviews. So I think keeping her alive through my network and my magazine is the best way to let everybody know that it's her fault that I review books and do radio. And I'm really proud of it.
I love it.
So thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to reading your next one. And as soon as you decide to do another blog tour, let me know so that I pencil you in right away.
I sure will. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Everybody have a nice day. And if you don't know what to do because it's going to rain, pick up a book and read. Bye.
Bye.